Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to our third week of our Black History Month celebration. Now, since Keegan is out of town, we decided to re-release an old episode. And when I say old, I went way back into the archives. I am taking you back to episode 6, Black Feminists, Audre Lorde and Shirley Chisholm. I hope that you all enjoy this throwback episode, and Keegan and I will be seeing you next week. Rage on, everyone.
Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we examine the world through our own personal feminist perspectives. That being said, this is mostly just our opinions. We do try to do some research and get our facts straight for the most part. But generally, it's Keegan and I having a safe space to share our opinions and a safe space for you to share yours as well.
Yeah, that's right. We're kind of just having open conversations about things that we find interesting and fascinating. And while, I mean, I know that we both do plenty of research and we take a lot of time to like try and make sure we get our facts straight, we may get some things wrong. So if that's the case, feel free to shoot us an email, shoot us a DM, and, you know, let us know what you think.
Slide into the DMs.
Yeah, slide right on in.
I mean, especially with like these kind of like book report ones we've been doing, like I know today for sure I'm missing out on so much. Like I am scratching the surface.
It's really hard when you're doing an entire life of somebody, especially somebody really great, to try and capture everything about
them. Yeah, you're not just telling one story, you're telling, like, their whole beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, and especially since you and I do try to fit in two different people in the span of, you know, under 2 hours.
It's, like, a little over an hour. We are talkers, too.
Yeah, we really are.
That's why we're friends.
So today we are going to be doing for the last week of Black History Month.
Boom!
I know, but we are heading into Women's History Month.
So good.
Which is also very exciting. So for the last week of Black History Month, we wanted to cover some Black women who were instrumental to the women's movement and to elevating not just Black voices, but also female voices or women-identifying voices.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Am I going first this time? Because you went first last time?
Yes, it's your turn.
Okay, so a bit of like a preface here. I was going to be doing somebody else. And
tell us who else you were going to be doing.
I was going to do Dorothy Pittman Hughes. Mm-hmm. And because I love the photo of her and Gloria Steinem, and I never really even, like, knew who that woman was, and I was like, that's not cool, because I have it on my keychain, too, and I was like, I need to know more about this person.
Right, so if you don't know what picture we're talking about, there's a very famous photo of Gloria Steinem and Dorothy Pittman Hughes standing next to each other, both with their fists up in the air.
And apparently they're sharing a skirt.
What?
Yeah.
I've never seen below the waist on that picture.
I have it on my keychain. I'll show you. And it looks like it, but it looks like they're just standing in front of something. But can we have that be our Halloween costume and, like, wear one big skirt?
Yeah.
We have to do it.
I am all about it.
Okay, good.
All about it.
All right. I just had to run that by you first. But, like, I was really upset because every time I would look stuff up about Dorothy, I would get stuff about Gloria Steinem. And I wasn't getting enough information about her. And she's really wonderful. Like, Oprah Winfrey names her as one of, like, the best moms. Like, she's, like, that's what she called her. She did great. A lot of things for childcare.
I will say, I don't really know much about her at all, really.
I mean, what I read from her, like, she's awesome. Like, she's just very, very, like, motherly. She's all about childcare and making sure that, you know, while the, like, minority Black families were out working, that their children had, like, safe places to be. And she seemed really, really wonderful. But I'd be talking about her for 10 minutes and that'd be it. And that's, she doesn't deserve that. So if I'm going to learn more about her, I really want to take the time to, like, find reliable sources and learn more about her.
And not just,
So with that being said, I switched over to Audre Lorde last night.
Fantastic.
So good.
One of my favorites.
So good. But I've only been looking at her for, like, less than 24 hours, so...
Well, the good thing about Audre is that the internet delivers on
The internet on straight Audre. Up delivers. So, she was born Audre, A-U-D-R-E-Y. You'll learn why that's important later. Geraldine Lorde, on February 18th, which is today.
Happy birthday, Audre.
Today. Wah, wah, wah. I think she would be, she would be like 94. She was born in 34, if my math serves me right, which it probably doesn't. She was a woman of many adjectives. Like, when she would describe herself, I know you're checking my math in your head.
It's fine. Continue.
It's fine. she just self-described herself as Black lesbian mother warrior poet. But she's so much more, and that's something for her that she was constantly... I mean, something for me definitely that drew me to her and that I really connected with is that she was always kind of expanding what her identity was and always looking for more inside of her, which is something that I really try to do as well, is to learn the most about myself as I can. So she was born to Caribbean immigrants from Barbados and Caracas. Oh my god, I literally just looked up how to say this. I think it's Caracou? Caracou. I'm just going to keep going.
I don't have my glasses on, so I can't read.
That's fine. So her mother was Linda, and she was mixed race, but she could pass as white, which was a source of pride in her family. Her mom's parents were a bit racist. There was a lot of colorism going on. And the only reason it was okay with her family to for Linda to marry Byron, Audrey's dad, who was much, much darker. The only reason it was okay was because he was very charming and had a lot of ambition. And she was still very prejudiced against her husband and against...
Yeah.
She very much looked down upon any darker colored people.
Mm-hmm. And which is so unfair. It's
so unfair.
Not only is it unfair to... the people around you just in general, but whenever
you've chosen to marry that person.
Well, you've chosen to marry them, and then in addition to that, your children are going to be darker skinned than you. Like, it's going to happen, you know?
So, I mean, that just kind of starts the whole outcast thing before Audrey is even born. She was so nearsighted when she was young that she was legally blind. But she grew up listening to her mother's stories a lot about, like, the West Indies. And a lot of it was, like, a lot of, like, pretty racist rhetoric. But she was very, very rebellious growing up and would challenge her parents. And her parents were very, very emotionally distant. Mm-hmm. They worked a lot. And when they were home, they weren't warm and fuzzy at all.
Not hands-on.
No. And they just weren't. They weren't warm and fuzzy. They weren't, like, loving people. And I think that from a very young age, Audrey was very loving. Probably this was, like around the Great Depression.
Yeah.
This was in the 30s.
Well, the 30s and then, like, 40s.
Early
probably,
40s,
because she was born in what year? 34?
34.
Okay. Yeah, so I think it's also just a characteristic of that time period and the way that people parented back then, too.
Definitely.
Like, they were just...
But, yeah, you hear about, like when I was talking about Rosa Parks, like, she had...
Very supportive figures.
She had very supportive... Mm-hmm. And Audrey didn't. Like, her family wasn't all very, like, nearby. She also was the youngest of three girls, and the older girls were very, very close. They kind of excluded her. As I was about to say, she's legally blind. She had to wear, like, corrective shoes. She had a lot of, like, disabilities, and she was also the youngest, so they felt that she got the most attention. So she kind of wasn't really...
One of three girls.
She's one of three.
Oh, so there's two older sisters. Okay.
Yeah. And they were really, really close.
So much
close.
In common with who I'm going to do later. I'm excited.
Well, what's funny is that they, like, the person who you're going to do later talks about her.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
I changed people. I didn't
what?
Tell you.
No way! No way.
Sorry, go ahead. Okay.
I love my life. Okay. So when she was four and she still couldn't speak. So she, like, as she was kind of learning to speak, she was simultaneously teaching herself to read and write.
Wow.
And she had a lot of issues with communication. She really, because she had speech issues and she had a stutter, and she also just didn't really always have the words to be able to describe how she felt. So she started memorizing poetry. So when people ask her how she was, she would recite poems back to her.
This reminds me so much of Maya Angelou. Because, you know, Maya Angelou was, like, mute for, like, years and years and years, and memorized books, like, in her head, too.
Yeah, and that's, and it gave her the words that she needed, and I think, there's definitely a lot of parallels where I think that probably gave them their eloquent speech, really, too. Like,
yeah.
They're not learning Elmo, they're learning, like, hardcore,
beautiful
poetry.
Made them
poetry.
Better poets,
totally. But she started writing her first poems when she was in, like, eighth grade. And the poetry she wrote connected herself to the other outcasts her age. She grew up going to... She started out going to a public school, I believe, where she was the only Black child. And then she went to a girls' school. And I have it written down somewhere. Hunter College High School. And she was still the only Black girl, but that was where she kind of, like, found her, like,
her like female group. So she like they had like a poetry club where they would like read poems to each other and stuff. And
word,
so
that's she, cool. Let's start a poetry club.
Oh, totally. Snap, snap. But that's kind of like she wanted to connect with other people that were that saw themselves as being outcasts as well. Oh my god, I'm gonna be burping through this entire episode.
We're drinking champagne.
Ugh,
for the second
so good.
Week in a row.
True that. Okay, and for me, the second day in a row. So, when she, around that same time, she started spelling her name A-U-D-R-E. When she was teaching herself to write, she, actually, it was probably before this time, because I heard on the, a lot of this stuff I got from Wikipedia, but even more of this stuff I got from stuff you missed in history class.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that, like, when she was learning, like, her penmanship, when she was writing her name, she's like, that doesn't look right. I don't like that, because of the way her last name was spelled. So she liked the way that the two E's looked. The ending of her names. Like, so she just had this, like, artistic, like, eye.
Yeah. Really.
Like, to look at your name and be like, that's not right? That's crazy.
Right. Yeah. So, it was, it's, she turned her name into poetry, which
she
is really
did.
Beautiful.
She really did. And she writes about it in her book, Zami, A New Spelling of My Name. She explains that she chose to drop the Y because of the way that it was looked, and she wanted it to kind of be different than the way that her parents spelled it.
Yeah, which again, I mean, I think we talked about this when we talked about Sojourner Truth, but there's something so, like, beautiful and empowering to me about choosing your name.
Right?
And, like, deciding who you are, you know? I think that's really, really beautiful.
I think so, too. I really, and that's something for me that I've actually thought about doing when I get married. I want to change my middle name.
Because
I think that, and this is probably something that we need to talk about at some point with taking your partner's name.
Uh-huh.
I would totally take Chris's name because at this point I feel more connected to that than I do with my father's name.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I would want to change my name to my mom's name.
Oh, her maiden name? Or
no,
her first name?
Her first name.
Oh, wow.
I think I would do Madigan Elizabeth.
I think it's beautiful.
Because I think it's cool, like, when you're, like, because when you're getting married and you're changing your name, like, it's a whole
You can
new,
do what
like,
you want, yeah.
Right, but it's, like, a whole new chapter of your life, and you can choose to make these differences. Like, you're leaving that, like, past self behind, and you're, like,
You're
creating.
Shedding your skin, kind
totally.
Of.
Totally, and, like, I think there's something so cool about taking power over what your name is. And so kind of getting back to her parents, she really didn't have the greatest relationship with them. Like I said, they were very tough on her. They just, like, her mom had some, like, you know, internalized racism going on, and especially with her mother, she had a lot of issues, and she wrote about it a lot in her later poetry. And there's a poem called Storybooks on a Kitchen Table, and the beginning of it I'm going to read real quick because it's beautiful. It says, out of her womb of pain, my mother spat me into her ill-fitting harness of despair, into her deceits where anger reconceived me, piercing my eyes like arrows, pointed by her nightmare of who I was not becoming.
Oh. Wow. She is such a phenomenal writer. I was telling you this whenever you told me who you're going to be doing today, but I remember when I was just, like, a little fledgling feminist, I read Sister Outsider, and it's been a really long time since I've read that, but her poetry is so powerful and beautiful and truthful.
It's like everything you read by her, it's like it's just, like, taking a knife to the heart in a good way.
It's so strong.
Yeah. It's just, there's everything about it just hits you in the gut.
Yeah, you can feel what she was writing when she wrote it. Like, when you read that, you can feel exactly how hurt she is.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not so, like, out there that you're like, this is weird. You know, it's not so descriptive and, like, I'm lost. It's just very to the point and beautiful.
Yeah, it's just her truth.
Yeah. So when she was at the Hunter College High School, it was a school for the intellectually gifted students, which was another thing there. She felt kind of on the outside because she was very smart. She was very, very gifted. She wrote a poem for, like, their school's, like, magazine, and she got, like, a letter back being like, this isn't appropriate, basically. So she was like, okay. So she sent it to 17 magazine, and she was published in 17 and got paid for it.
Wow.
Like,
that's how old was she?
She was in, like, eighth grade. This
that's
is
amazing.
Still, like, her high school. Like, she's probably in, like, eighth or ninth grade. And then she started doing workshops at the Harlem Writers Guild. But again, she felt very outside of there. She was like, I was both crazy and queer, but they thought I would grow out of it. So now.
And I feel like that's such a parallel to a lot of people feel like when they're in school. I mean, a lot of gay kids or just kids who are othered in general.
Yes.
Like, that's how people
look
at you.
It's a word that they use a lot when discussing her, that she uses to describe herself, is that I'm sick of being other. So I'm going to start kind of getting into her homosexuality a little bit.
Great.
She's a proud Black lesbian woman, and she really started at a very young age having very intense relationships with women. Like, even before it was, like, romantic, she would have very, like, strong female, like, bonds and relationships. Mm-hmm. And when she was at Hunter College High School, she, I think the first kind of, like, I guess, quote-unquote girlfriend, I think her name was Genevieve, but I could be wrong, but it was a very intense thing. And I don't think, I mean, they were so young, I don't think it was sexual. I think it was just a very, like,
intense
loving,
emotional bond.
Yes. And she... this Genevieve, if I'm getting the name right, actually committed suicide when she was 16.
Oh, wow.
Which was just...
devastating, I'm sure.
Devastating to her. And she dealt with depression at a very, very young age before it was really recognized as being what it was. And she just kind of went into this downward spiral. But she would continue to have, you know, beautiful relationships with women as she went on through her life. And it kind of went off and on as she was able to kind of, like, explore it more. But she had a lot of secret relationships.
And yeah, she kind well, of, I like, mean, especially looking at the time, it would have to be a secret.
Yeah.
You know, because at that time, I mean, I'd have to look at the laws, but even some of the laws were discriminatory against...
She said... I read somewhere that, like, her... Well, the other thing is that she still dated men, but she would, like, still have female relationships. Mm-hmm. But she always dated white men. So, like, that was, like...
Interesting.
Was, yeah, she always dated... She married a white man eventually, which I'll get to. But she, you know, so there was always kind of that mixed relationship kind of, like, drama. Mm-hmm. And her parents knew that she was dating a white man, which is weird because her mom was so racist against, like, dark skin, but she was also very, like, you're not dating a white guy, though.
It was like, a mixed bag. Like, it really wasn't
was
a double-edged...
She was stuck between a rock and a hard place. Yeah. Like, well, then who the fuck am I supposed to date?
A light-skinned black man is probably what they wanted. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. I might be getting the timeline a little bit wrong here because I heard different things from Wikipedia and from the podcast. But at one point, she attended the University of Mexico, which she described as another time of affirmation and renewal. During this time, she continued to have relationships with women and white men. Upon returning to New York, she graduated from Hunter College in 59. So it was the school that was, like, connected to her high school. And at this point, her parents, like, kind of disowned her. She had to kind of, like, make her way through. She worked as a librarian and she continued writing, and she was an active participant in gay culture of Greenwich Village. So she would go to, like, these lesbian bars, but she was neither butch or femme. And at that point, and she was Black. Like, so she didn't fit into any of those boxes and felt very, like, she was just going to this place to try to find a place to belong.
I mean, this was at a time when, I mean, obviously, which, I mean, we'll talk about later, obviously the term intersectionality wasn't coined until, like, the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
But even the idea, I mean, because during second wave feminism, they discussed it a teensy bit.
Yeah.
You know, Black feminists in general discussed it a little bit. But usually, whenever those discussions were happening in the second wave, it was, you thought of it as being either, like, white women who were feminists, or if you were intersectional, it was, like, a person of color and a woman. But oftentimes, they didn't talk about those,
there was,
like,
no homosexual, like...
Yeah, I mean, there was a homosexual presence during the second wave of feminism, but you didn't look at it in terms
but
of it being, like...
But it wasn't connected
as
much.
Yeah, and if you looked at it like that, then it was just, like, our brains couldn't handle more than two things.
Oh, she was a million
things,
and that's the thing. And it gets... She gets even more, like, out there as she gets older. Like, she's just like, I am who I am. She earned a master's degree in library science from Columbia in 61. And during this time, she worked as a public librarian again in Mount Vernon. She was the only Black employee. Lord also spent time at, I think it's Tougaloo College. And, like, her time at the University of Mexico, very formative again, but this was for more so for her as an artist. She led a lot of workshops for young Black undergraduate students. And this was, like, in the Deep South, I heard, too. So it was very, like, controversial. But she talked a lot with these Black undergraduate students about civil rights issues. And she really reaffirmed her desire not only to live her crazy and queer identity, but also to devote attention to formal aspects of her craft as a poet. So she started really expressing more of her truth in her writing. She continued to become a professor of English. I mean, she would speak all over the place and talk to different groups of people. At one point, she went to Germany in 84, and she did a lecture when they were kind of coining the term Afro-German, because we had African-American. They mm-hmm. were coining this Afro-German. Right. Mm-hmm. And she really kind of, like, gave a new light to the people of Germany for people like her. And it also really made her dig more into her own African culture. She started kind of dressing more in the African, traditional African styles. And just kind of felt like there would be ancestry there. She, you know, tried to find, like, proof of her father's, like, birth there or grandfather. And so mm-hmm. she
a deep connection to her heritage.
She just wanted to know everything about herself that she uh-huh. could, which I think is amazing and something that I definitely can, like, feel along with her. Her poetry was so deeply rooted in the differences in oneself. She said, "I am defined as other in every group I'm part of," she would say. Mm-hmm. She described herself both as part of a continuum of women and a concert of voices within herself. Mm-hmm. So she very much connected with women, but she was just this concert of voices in her head. There was so much going on at once, and she couldn't have it all fit together yet. Her poetry was published a lot in the 60s, and during that time, she also focused on civil rights, anti-war, feminism in her writing. Mm-hmm. She was there for the March on Washington when Martin Luther King gave his speech, but she actually wasn't there for his speech. She heard it in the car with her husband at the time. And, but she...
Bummer.
Right? But she still states it as being... I mean, it was still incredibly moving, you mm-hmm. know, and she still states it as being, like, one of those really, like, big turning points for her. Her writing is based on the theory of difference, the idea that the binary opposition between men and women is overly simplistic, while most feminists of the time found it necessary to present the illusion of a solid, unified whole. Her writing was always strongly based in race and sexuality. In her essay, The Erotic as Power, Lorde emphasizes the importance of exploring one's sexuality fully to grow a closer connection to themselves, which was fucking radical at the
time.
I'm
sure, yeah.
This is before even, like, the hippie movement.
This is before, like, the feminine mystique or any of that stuff was going on.
And she's like, yeah, like, women, explore your sexuality. Don't deny yourself any experience.
Well, and especially at a time like that, whenever you weren't encouraged to kind of, like, figure yourself out, how could you possibly... Yeah. If you were just told exactly what you were supposed to be, mm-hmm. how are you supposed to know anything else if you didn't explore that?
The thing with her, it started with her name change. Mm-hmm. She took control completely of her mm-hmm. life. And she was like, I don't have to do anything that these people are telling me. This is the way I'm going to live my truth. And she was a bit of a trailblazer in the intersectional feminist movement. As we said, she felt a connection to the poet Alice Walker's term womanist uh-huh. In an attempt to distinguish black female and minority female experience from feminism.
Yeah, I actually, because I'm in, I was in several groups that were like black feminism groups. Uh-huh. And a lot of black women, I'd never heard that before. Like, even though I'd, you know, read some Audre Lorde and things like that, I'd never really heard black women not wanting to label themselves as feminists and instead actively labeling themselves as womanists.
I mean, I think it's great. And I think that if you feel like you have to separate it in order for it to feel more...
Well, they were separating themselves from a movement that they felt didn't serve them.
Exactly.
You know what
and
I mean?
And if that's what you have to do in order to feel like you're living true to who you are, that's mm-hmm. what you have to do, you know? Alice Walker's comments on womanism is that a womanist is to feminist as purple is to lavender.
Right.
It's just a bit of a shift from what we know as feminism. And Lorde actively strived to change the culture within the feminist community by implementing the womanist ideology. Lorde states that womanism allows black women to affirm and celebrate their color and culture in a way that feminism does not.
Right.
Every time I'm saying Lorde now, I'm thinking of the singer Lorde. It just popped into my head, and I was like, that's not
no,
right.
She doesn't get to have that.
She doesn't get to have that at all. At one point, Lorde attacked underlying racism with feminism, describing it as unrecognized dependence on the patriarchy. She argued that by denying difference in the category of women, white feminists merely furthered old systems of the operation, and that in doing so, they were preventing any real lasting change. Mm-hmm. Her argument aligned white feminists who did not recognize race as a feminist issue with male slave masters, describing both as agents of oppression, mm-hmm. which is crazy because, like, that's something that you and I have a lot of conversations about, the difference between white feminism and regular feminism, that is still, or I shouldn't say regular feminism, intersectional feminism.
Right, to us, regular feminism.
That a lot of people don't understand. Like, when we first started this podcast, I was on the phone with my mom, telling her, because originally we were going to be doing an intersectional episode a while ago. Mm-hmm. And so I was, she was like, what is that? What is white feminism? What? And I explained it to her and I was like, you know, it's an acknowledgement of your privilege and like knowing that feminism is more than just about being a woman. It's about all of these other things that
right, and
along
it, and it's called white feminism because the movement aligned so closely with white middle class women, yeah, and really kind of didn't speak to the experiences or the individual or very unique struggles of people of color or people of even a different social class.
Yeah,
you know, it really didn't,
or disability, serve, yeah, or religion, yeah, or it was very much one type of woman, I feel like, at right, first, that was very
And next
focused
week,
on.
You'll hear more about that when we talk about the
first
suffragettes.
She says, as white women ignore their built-in privilege of whiteness and define women in terms of their own experience alone, that women of color become other, which, like, just the language she's using is, like, language that we are using mm-hmm. right now. Blows. Yeah. Like, this could be someone who made a speech yesterday.
She had a very modern way of looking at life and at feminism.
Yes.
At a time when just other people weren't thinking that way.
Phrasing.
And she
don't
had,
ignore your built-in privilege.
Yeah.
Come on, that's amazing.
And she had the ability to state it in a very transparent way.
Yeah. Like, well, and in a way that a lot of people, even white feminists, wouldn't, like, you know, she did have a lot of criticism, but I think a lot of people also would probably listen to her and be like, oh.
Because if you're really listening, you cannot argue with that.
No, you can't. And it's, you know, people, whenever you say privilege to somebody who really doesn't understand, they're going to get
their
offended.
Guard goes straight up. It's
they're
the
like,
same thing.
Wait, no, I'm not privileged. What do you mean? I've seen hardships. And but it's like, no, we're not saying
that's not,
that.
That's not what we're talking about. Yeah, but I mean, even the term white feminism gets people's, you know, hackles raised and they get really defensive.
Oh, I mean, the first time I heard it, I felt like, oh, does that mean that I'm less of a feminist? You know what I mean? You start to kind of question what that means, but then as soon as you learn more about it, you realize that it's not a bad thing. I always say, use your powers of privilege for good and not evil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Lord defines racism, sexism, ageism, heterosexism, elitism, and classism together and explains that an ism is an idea, what is being privileged is superior and has the right to govern anything else.
That's so...
It's just all the isms.
That's such an amazing way to put it. Mm-hmm. She had such a way with words that can make anyone understand anything,
yeah.
I feel like.
Yeah. Lord explains that a mythical norm is what all bodies should be. The mythical norm of U.S. culture is white, thin, male, young, heterosexual, Christian, financially secure. So it's like, that's this myth that's what the norm is, but the norm, like, really doesn't exist.
And when you take, and I think it's so, especially coming out of the time that she came out of, I think that's what even white men were trying to portray that.
Yeah.
Even if you just took the segment of, like, white men in America at that time and just looked under a microscope at it for, like, any amount of time, you would start to see all different kinds of variations of people that they were just trying to bury and hide, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly. And that's the thing that she was so accepting of is, like, she wasn't just for one type of people. She was one for the outcast, whatever mm-hmm. that meant. In the late 80s, she also helped establish the Sisterhood in Support of Sisters in South Africa to benefit Black women who were affected by apartheid and other forms of injustice. And, like, that I was just like, what? Because I'm trying to get this hashtag sister solidarity thing going. And I want to hear people's sister solidarity stories. And, like, oh my God. Like, she and a couple other women, I can't remember their names off the top of my head, started it all.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, they did that.
Women helping women. You know, I think
they wanted to help stop the innate competition that we are told is just ingrained into us. Oh, don't get a bunch of girls together. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, because women can't help but fight with each other.
Right. Well,
when really,
we're taught to do
we,
it.
I mean, we are absolutely conditioned to do that.
Yeah.
But also, I think part of the power in getting older and really discovering female friendships is that you realize this is the best support system mm-hmm. that I could possibly have. And I'm not undermining my male friendships.
Not
like,
at
I have
all.
Incredible male friendships, like ones that I value so much.
Yeah.
But that whole, like, women helping women, we have, like, unique issues that we can help each other with.
Exactly. And, you know, women of all variations, really, like, you
bring
know, they
something
say,
to the table.
You know,
yeah.
support your sisters, not your sisters. And yeah. Like that. You know, it's like, it's good to just support everybody. So now I'm going to touch a little bit more on kind of her relationships because it's very fascinating. She's very, very, like, again, ahead of her time when it comes to her relationships. Audrey had relationships with both men and women, but she married Edwin Rollins when she had two children. And it was pretty much just kind of agreed with them that, like, they wouldn't be faithful, but they would be open to it. It was an open relationship, basically.
Mm-hmm, an open marriage.
And, yeah, and Edwin, though he never came out as gay, he had a lot of gay affairs. Like, he was pretty gay. Like, for someone who's not gay, he was pretty gay.
I wonder if now, with all of our accepted identities and understanding that understanding that sexuality is a spectrum, yeah. I wonder what he would identify as now. Like, pansexual? Bisexual?
I wonder what she would identify. You know, she loved him, but she wasn't in love with him.
Well, maybe maybe it really is like a pansexuality where it's just like you love who you love and it makes no difference.
I mean, actually, I think with Audrey, she probably was more of a lesbian because she does describe
her love for her husband. I thought she identified that way.
She did identify as a lesbian. But she had love for him, but not like the love that you should have when you get married to somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know what? I think also, it's not exactly what I want for myself, but I think it's also kind of an interesting thing to think about the idea of marrying somebody who you know loves you and is going to be committed to you and is going to be... We have this idea of, like, romantic love and romantic marriages, yeah. But maybe there's something to be said about committing your life to someone and spending your life with someone who maybe you're not sexually attracted to or romantically attached to, but you know that love that you have for that person is going to last forever.
Well, I think that's kind of where, like, asexuality is going with, like, asexual relationships.
Yeah, and you can have, like, a meaningful, lasting relationship with someone.
Yeah, and it totally depends on the person. For a lot of people, that might not work, but for a lot of people, that's probably something they feel needs to be more of in the world and represented more because that's not a normal thing. I say normal in quotations, but while she was married to Edwin, she was having a relationship with a woman named Frances, and it was a very, again, very intense love affair, and they were together for a really long time. Ed and Audrey were really ahead of their time with their parenting style. They were a mixed-race homosexual couple, spoke openly with their children about social issues. I wrote Audrey was a total 2018 mom and made homemade whole grain bread and limited their kids' sugar intake. Like, it was crazy.
She would have shopped at Whole Foods, probably.
For sure. And she was she really wanted her son, Jonathan, to kind of follow in her footsteps of being this, like, activist. And he, you know, as kids do, don't always follow in their parents' footsteps. So that was a bit of a frustrating thing
and
for
as
her.
They shouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, you're your own individual.
Exactly. Well, things started getting a little shaky in her marriage with Ed because as she was very, very open with having relationships with women, especially mm-hmm. with Frances, he snuck around a little bit more. That did not make her very happy. She's like, if we're going to do this, you got to be, like, open with me about
it.
Well,
why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing I don't quite
because
understand.
I think he was closeted gay, and he I just don't think he was comfortable with, like, expressing that.
If that's the case, how sad is that?
That's probably what it was.
Sad is it that you're in a relationship with somebody who fully supports and understands what you're going through, and
but
you
that's
still can't.
Internalized homophobia, though,
I know.
You know? Like, you just can't get past it. From 77 to 78, Lord had a brief affair with a sculptor and painter, Mildred Thompson. This is when her health starts to kind of go downhill. And while her health is going downhill, she is still traveling up a storm. She's going to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. She's going back to Germany.
And still writing.
I mean, she never stops. Mm-hmm. She never stopped. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 78. And she first found a lump, and it was benign. And then she, like, basically learned as much as she could about it and started writing about cancer. And then in 78, when she was actually diagnosed, she already was, like, fully versed in it and, like, was prepared. When she was a little bit younger, she fell in love with a woman who was 27 years older than her and had mm-hmm. breast cancer and had a mastectomy. Mm-hmm. And so, although she never stated this as being the reason why, she got a mastectomy. I'm sure there was something to do with that influence that she had when she was young. Seeing someone.
So she didn't need one medically?
She did need one.
Oh, okay.
She had breast cancer. She had one of her breasts removed.
Okay.
So she did need it, but she writes a lot in the cancer journals about how when she got her mastectomy, the sexism that went along with it, where, like, doctors and nurses and everybody would be like, okay, when are we getting the prosthetic in? When are we? And she's like, we're not. And, like, they just couldn't fathom why she would only want one breast. And she started dressing really asymmetrical on purpose. Like, she was like, this is the way my body is now, so I'm going to celebrate it, and I'm going to do things this
way. Gosh, there's something so phenomenal and brave about just her inherent desire to accept herself.
Well, like, and it's incredible. Was just this hippie chick. She's like, she didn't want radiation. She was like, I'm gonna eat only fruits and vegetables, and I'm gonna pray on it. And
okay,
she did all of, I know.
If you're listening to this, please don't take that route.
But she was just like super holistic and like, you know, but this is also like in the 70s, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, no, but I know people now who do that. I think I saw recently, and I was just like, look, man, don't do that. Like,
don't do it.
We have, like, science is pretty good nowadays. Right. Like, please get.
But what's crazy is, like, she, like, a few years after they, like, diagnosed her with cancer, she had another CAT scan, and they were like, well, it hasn't gotten any bigger. She's like, cool, it's working. So she just kept doing it for a while, and then it, you know, obviously didn't. And eventually, because of her breast cancer, she got liver cancer. And the book that she wrote, The Cancer Journals, won the American Library Association.
I can't say that word either.
God, I can usually say it. What happened? Maybe because I'm, like, around you, it just, like, transferred to me. The gay, I can never say this word, caucus book.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of makes me laugh.
Caucus. Well, get ready, because there's a lot of that in mine.
Caucus. In 1981. Oh, I also, God, I need better endings to my stories, because I fucking...
When did she die?
She, fuck.
It's okay. Here.
She died.
She did die.
She did die. She died on November 17th, 1992, the year I was born, in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. She really saw the Caribbean as her home. She found that as her home, and she lived with Mildred until she passed away.
At the time she passed away?
Yeah, they were really, and I believe it was Mildred or somebody else. One of her, yeah, I think it was Mildred. I believe she wrote a book talking about her time with her. I just did some light YouTube searching and stuff like that, and I saw a few things with her, so I definitely want to look into that more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was just this, like, the definition of a free spirit. Like, just
and her writings are just so, I really, like, you will so enjoy reading Sister Outsider.
Oh, I'm for sure going to
read it. Definitely do it. I'm going to buy it, because I don't own it, but it was something that really shaped me. And I remember, I'm going to a rally tomorrow for people against gun violence in the wake of the Parkland shooting. And I thought about writing it on my poster, as I think about writing it on my poster every single time whenever I go to a rally, any rally.
What were you going
to
write?
I always want to write, because it resounded so much in me and is something that made me kind of, like, come out of my shell. Your silence will not protect you.
Oh, yes.
Because that was something that when I was reading Sister Outsider, I was just like, oh my God, like, it hit me like a cannonball to the chest, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just like, your silence will not protect you. Like,
no.
You can sit there and be quiet and be in your bubble and pretend like nothing's going on.
But then nothing is going to change.
And there's no guarantee that that makes you safe.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're not, just because you can close your eyes to it and it can make you feel
it's
safe.
It's like a little kid who puts their bed covers over their heads and the monsters don't get them. You
yeah,
know?
But if the monster's coming, it's coming. And,
it's coming and it's you know, gonna... It's gonna find you somehow.
Yeah.
For me, just the radical act of self-love, you know what I mean? That's something for me that I am so obsessed with in my own life, and to constantly be finding new ways to make myself better is something that I am very passionate about, and ways for me to constantly be growing and learning and changing. I don't think we should ever be satisfied with the way we are. Love yourself the way you are, but never be satisfied and say, okay, I'm good enough as the way.
Yeah,
there's always more you can learn.
Love yourself where you're at, but also know that you have so much further to go.
Exactly.
You know, like, there's, and you're going to evolve and you're going to change, and you should always be seeking that within yourself. You know what I mean?
Like, right. And that doesn't mean, like, oh, constantly be changing your outward appearance, which is, I think, a lot of times what society sees it as. Like, oh, become your best self. Work out 5 hours a day. It's like, no, it's about, if you're going to be, I mean, I'll talk more about this in, like, our body positivity episode, where it's like, if you're gonna be changing yourself, you first have to accept yourself for the way that you are, if you're changing the outside.
If you're not happy, if you're not, like, okay, just to slightly dip into this, but, like, if you are not pleased with your body right now, or if you're not pleased with who you are in your body right now, and I can say this from experience of being very thin, and I was very thin before, and I always thought, like, when I would get that thin, I would be happy.
But
you know, but I was not happy.
Yeah.
I was not happy with my body when I was at the size that I thought I'd be happy with my body at. You know what I mean? It's just like,
it's
if you're not
about
comfortable.
The internal thing. And it's, and it's also about not being afraid, I feel like, to let others tell you that you're wrong. And I feel like that's something that she really stood for, like, in the way that she dressed after she got her mastectomy. She didn't want a prosthesis. She lived as a pretty openly lesbian woman.
At a time when it was very dangerous and scary to do so.
Well, it was incredible. She was a black woman. Like, that's dangerous enough. Slap gay on top of that. Damn.
Yeah,
like,
and the time.
Scary.
Yeah.
And so, to me, like, that's so who I want to be in my life. I want to be so unapologetic. I love making people feel uncomfortable with the way that I, like, radically love myself and, like, with the way that I talk about, you know, myself and the people around me. And, like, reading about her was, like, reading about the person that I want to be when I'm older.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
just so comfortable.
Just completely at peace. And I feel like, you know, and I'm sure she never even felt like she was completely at peace because you're constantly evolving. You know what I mean? But
I need to look it up. There's a Japanese term for never being satisfied, which is something that you've talked about before. And there is an actual word for it in Japanese. I can't remember what
it
is.
God, that phrasing can be taken in such a wrong way.
No,
I'm never satisfied.
Not in a bad way. In the best way of saying, like, I always want to evaluate where I'm at and see where I'm going, because no one wants to be stuck in the same place forever.
No, it
and
sucks.
And I'm so happy that I've been able to do a little bit of that for myself and realizing that I have so far to go, but also, like, realizing, like, I'm so pleased with myself with the progress that I've made in the last 5 years.
Don't you feel like even within the last, like, month you've changed so much?
Absolutely.
Because the information that I have, even since starting this podcast, is, like, wild.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Yeah, I think always pursue in that, like, acting in that pursuit of growth and change and positive change is just the most beautiful thing.
You're
you can
never
going to
get a negative outcome from that ever.
It's the most radical form of self-love that you can do.
Most definitely.
Just completely evaluate yourself.
I feel so bougie right now. I still have, like, this, like, faux fur stole on
Madigan
my shoulder.
Likes to wear my, like, faux mink stole that I have in my closet when we record.
I'm not bougie at all. But
no,
this
listen,
makes me feel
come,
so good.
Come to my house, drink a mimosa, wear a mink stole, and feel good about yourself, girl. For
I feel
like
I need to just be, like, I need to record one day just in, like, lingerie and heels and this stole.
We can do that. We should do that, actually.
A lingerie episode where we're just sitting.
When we talk about, when we do an undergarments episode, which I want us to do one, you know, we should totally just do it in lingerie.
I don't have any lingerie.
I do, but you shouldn't wear it.
No. I have, like, I got, like, a high-waisted, like, lace underwear from Urban Outfitters, but, like, you will see straight up vagine when I do that. Like, it'll be like, this is my vagina.
I mean, look.
Let's chat.
We're all friends here.
We're all
in the closet.
Here.
I'll tell Anthony to go away for a while.
I mean, we just told him that we're going to be making out in the closet for the next 3 hours. That's what
he's
we're
like,
really
whatever
doing.
Makes the money, that's
only 10 more coins,
look,
guys.
Man, you got to get those listeners. All we have to do is lie to them and tell clickbait. Okay, well, thank you so much for that story, Madigan.
Thanks for letting me talk for 45 minutes. Damn, I need more mimosa.
Yeah, we're going to go take a mimosa break. And when we get back, we are going to talk about...
Who?
Shirley Chisholm. Hey there, listeners. Keegan here. Did you know that our girl Madigan is coming out with her own adult coloring book? The Inappropriate Coloring Book is chock full of feminist slogans, curse words, and potty humor, all framed by Madigan's awesome hand-drawn designs. The full book isn't available just yet, but if you'd like to purchase individual prints or just check out what's to come, follow the Instagram page at The Inappropriate Coloring Book or check out her Etsy page at etsy.com/shop/bemoreinappropriate.
My body is ready, Keegan.
All right, we're back. Madigan is all banana breaded up.
So good.
Right? And we've got new mimosas. We're freshly mimosa'd.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we are going to talk about one of my favorite people who I'm ashamed to say, up until the last couple of years of my life, I did not know who she was. And to me, it's like...
I mean, that's how I feel about a lot of, like, the feminist heroes that I'm...
Yeah,
it's a fan of.
It's really upsetting. And
but think of how many years you have to go.
Yeah, of course.
So many years of loving
But
them.
For this woman in particular, I'm shocked that we didn't learn about her in school, and you will find out why.
I'm okay. So excited. Go for it.
So, Shirley Anita St. Hill was born to immigrant parents, and her parents were also from the Caribbean.
Oh,
her
cool.
father was from Guyana, and then her mother was from Barbados.
Mm.
And,
Wait, what year was she born?
She was born in 1924.
Yo!
Yeah, so very
crazy.
Much a contemporary of Audre Lorde, really.
Like, yeah.
A 10-year difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy, because they lived in Barbados for a while, and she, like, visited Barbados.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So she was born in Brooklyn on November 20th, 1924.
She lived in freaking Harlem.
I know, I'm telling
Nuts.
You. They probably knew each other, to be honest.
Oh, for sure. Like,
and she was also she was the oldest of four girls. So she was the all daughters again. So from the ages of 3 to 10, Shirley lived with her grandparents on a farm in Barbados in order to receive a British education. Her parents wanted her to not only to receive a British education, but also they were trying to build a home for themselves in Brooklyn. And like her mother was a seamstress and her father, I can't remember what her father did, but they were basically like they were just trying to build a nice solid family life.
Trying to get by.
For the daughters to come back to. So she spent 7 years in Barbados going to school.
Can we go to Barbados one day? That just sounds amazing.
Doesn't it? It sounds very nice. Anthony and I want to go to Aruba next year for his birthday.
So good.
We're gonna do it. But when Shirley returned to Brooklyn, she excelled in public school and eventually graduated from the Brooklyn Girls' School in 1942. Upon graduation, Shirley was accepted into both Oberlin and Vassar, so Ivy League colleges.
Damn!
Yeah, but instead opted to go to Brooklyn College on scholarship.
Mm.
So she...
Smart. Save some money.
Yeah. So she went to college, and she was encouraged, actually, to pursue a career in politics because of her quick mind and debating skills.
Mm.
However, she replied that she did not think it was a feasible option due to her, what she described as a double handicap, being both Black and a woman. She just thought that... She just thought politics wasn't an option for her, you know?
Yeah.
Despite not wanting to pursue a career in politics, she remained incredibly active in campus life. She joined the debate team, and when a social club on campus denied her entry due to her race, she started her own and called it Epothia, which stood for In Pursuit of the Highest in All.
Ooh.
Which is awesome. I kind of want to join that club.
Yeah. Bring it back.
We totally should. We should have our own Epothia.
I'm down.
In 1946, Shirley graduates cum laude and begins working as a nursery school teacher. And in 1949, she marries Conrad Q. Chisholm, a private investigator.
Love. Love it.
I know. Power couple.
Yeah, for sure.
In 1952, while working as a teacher, she earns her master's degree in early childhood education from Columbia University. Columbia?
They both went to Columbia. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
And becomes the director of two daycare centers. And this is kind of when...
That kind of reminds me of Dorothy Pittman Hughes, too, because she did a lot of, like, daycare, childcare stuff. That's cool.
Yeah, and that's a theme that you'll see run throughout Shirley's life, and definitely the thing that she, I think, began her passion and began, like, getting her into politics.
Cool.
Never one to slow down. By 1960, she was a consultant to the New York City Department of Daycares. And ever aware of racial and gender inequality, around this time, Chisholm joined local chapters of the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, the Urban League, and the Democratic Party Club in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood. So Bedford, whatever Stuy stands for, I can't ever pronounce it, but the Bedford neighborhood of Brooklyn. This club had been working diligently to weed out white leaders of the predominantly Black neighborhood who said that they were ignoring Black residents. Mm. So even though this neighborhood was predominantly Black and they had like an ever-growing Latino population, the people who were kind of running shit were all white people.
Yeah.
And so the neighborhood was really trying to amplify Black voices at that time.
That's good.
Shirley was so loud and relentless that eventually the powers that be placed her on the board of directors, hoping that it would shut her up. But of course it didn't. And she grew even...
She's like, now I have more voice.
Yeah, now they really just gave her a platform.
Pretty much.
Yeah, to like get shit done.
Yeah.
So She grew even louder and more vocal about community issues until eventually they removed her from the post.
Shouldn't have done that. No. Shirley is going to come back.
They're like, we did exactly the wrong thing.
Yeah, exactly. And she's just like, oh, yeah, you're going to take me down? Watch.
No, she just, honestly, I feel like she's so incredible. And we'll see throughout this story that I really feel like every obstacle that she, up until a point, I think every obstacle that, like, was thrown at her just kind of spurred her on and made her stronger.
Yeah.
In 1962, a black man was elected to the state assembly, Thomas R. Jones. However, in 1964, Jones decided to step down to pursue a judgeship. And who did the people want to step in to be their New York legislator, state legislator, but Shirley? Because she was so active in the community that people knew her.
I love it.
And, you know, they wanted her in there.
Like,
so
did both men and women want her in there?
In her neighborhood, yes.
Yeah. Yay,
because
girl!
she was so active and so smart. So she became the second black woman ever to be elected to the New York State Legislature.
Love it.
During this time, she was able to pass two bills that brought her great pride. One that established a program to help disadvantaged high schoolers go to college, and the other that changed the practice of revoking tenure for teachers who got pregnant. Because what the fuck?
What the fuck? It's like, oh, you reproduced? Yeah, all that work you just did, gone.
It absolutely was like a practice at the time.
But you're not allowed to abort the baby either, because that's not allowed.
Right, don't do that. Don't get pregnant outside of wedlock. Just be an old maid, I guess, if you're going to be a teacher. I mean, I think it's because they expected you to just completely quit working, you know, and not come back at this time. We're talking about a time when women couldn't have credit cards in their own name.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just an incredibly messed up time.
Those were the days, right? So not in a good way.
Not in a good way. And so she was able to get that changed, though, which is incredible.
That is amazing. I mean, the fact that, like, it's one of those things where it's like, we talk about the way that, like, laws are made. And a lot of this I know from Legally Blonde. It's like, it takes a lot. It doesn't take just one person to have an idea about something changing. There's so many hoops that you have to go through for things to actually change. So the fact that she had this idea and felt so strongly about it, but was actually able to implement it is nuts.
Well,
like, that's amazing.
She's an incredible speaker. Like, I'll touch on this a little bit later, but, like, she was able to get things. If she wasn't able to get them through, she was able to change people's minds about so many things.
Well, and that's interesting. So what we were talking about, Audrey, too, it's just like when she speaks, you can't deny what you've heard.
Right, yeah.
You've heard something where you just, like, even if you're going to put your guard up, you really just can't deny what
you've
heard.
Yeah, you can't say anything other than, well, I just don't like you. You know what I mean? Like, you can't say that what they're telling you isn't true or it doesn't make sense. Yeah. In 1968, Shirley decides to run for Congress using the slogan Unbought and Unbossed, which remained her slogan throughout her career, was the title of her autobiography. And then in, I think, 2004, there was a documentary which I watched in preparation for this episode called Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed. And it's so good. Like,
that's the opposite of Donald Trump.
It's, truly. Yeah, truly. And I would so...
The antithesis.
And, like, it's honestly, because I feel like a lot of politicians will say things like that because they know it sounds good. But she was, I mean...
She seems pretty transparent. Like,
everything
like what you see is what you get.
And everything she does, as you'll see, is a common theme throughout her life and her career. She does for the people. Like, she really is, like, the people's politician, you know?
That's amazing because there's such... Even, like, for me now... When I hear about politics, like, there's such, like, a negative connotation because it's, like, even, like, the best, like, besides Barack Obama, because I love everything about him, like, I feel like there's always, like, a motive. And Bernie Sanders.
Well,
I feel like he's a good
man. I think even with those people, I think that they're appealing and they're definitely...
I know, but you don't know... That's the thing is you never know who to trust.
It's not obvious. That's exactly right. Like, if you've ever seen The Ides of March, that movie, I think that is what it drives home for you, is that it's just like even people who... Or even if you ever watch this kind of a touchy subject now, but if you'd watched House of Cards, like, that's kind of like the thing. It's just like... It is just such a game of, like, a power play, and there's so much deceit, and so much of it is putting on this mask of being... I just don't know, because...
No one's transparent.
Like, and in order to get ahead, there's so much stuff that they have to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Especially, well, I mean, if we're going to talk about Barack Obama, like, I mean, we're talking about this woman right now who's a Black woman who is making huge moves in politics. But, like, even when Barack Obama was being elected president, being the first Black president, like, there's, he had to have, like...
Absolutely, he took money from, I mean,
but
I...
He had, but, no, but, I mean, he, there were probably a lot of things that he had to really do to get just to that point, because that's not an easy road.
Absolutely, and I'm sure there's a certain amount of compromising, which we'll see it worked out for Shirley Chisholm in some ways, but in some other ways, her inability to compromise her character and her integrity really didn't help her career-wise. You know what I mean?
Right, but I mean, but look, this is the person we're talking about right now, and we're praising for that.
Oh, yeah, no, amazing. It's what makes her so incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're, and just like to also kind of say, like, I'm not saying that, you know, we're not saying Obama did any certain things. And honestly, I'm so glad that he was president and did the things that he did. So I hope what we were just saying
that. Like,
absolutely. I don't want to get any messages being like, but he did so good. It's like, I know, I love him. Right. I wish he were my dad.
He did a lot of good things. But, you know, a politician is a politician. And exactly. In order to reach that,
there's
the
always
highest,
that question mark. You don't know.
You don't know. I mean, and honestly, there is some stuff that I know about, you know, contributions that he took and things like that, that aren't great. You know what I mean? But that's part of any, like, businessman's life, is that there is, like, a certain amount of compromise that goes on.
Yeah. But not for Shirley. Shirley's like,
I don't think so. So in 1968, Shirley decided to run for Congress on the campaign slogan Unbought and Embossed, which would remain her campaign slogan throughout her career. Shirley had a particularly up-close and personal campaign style, going so far as to say, you have to let the people feel you. So she would go out and go door to door and let these people, like, shake hands with these people. And I saw, like, in that documentary, you know, she did not care, like, what color you were, your age, anything like that. She would, you know, hold your hand, come in and give you, like, a kiss on the cheek and a hug.
How did, like, but, like, if she were going to, like, white neighborhoods, how did they respond to that?
Well, I think this was mostly, like, in her neighborhood at this time and at rallies and things like that. But she had the distinct advantage also of being bilingual. So she spoke Spanish.
Love it.
And with there being so many Latino people in her neighborhood, it really did give her an advantage over her Republican opponent. He was a Republican liberal. So actually, I know Madigan just made a face like, he actually had very similar views to Shirley Chisholm. He was a Black man.
Yeah.
And he had very similar views to her, actually. But he couldn't relate to the people the way that she related to the people.
Yeah.
And also he was in, I think what actually ended up losing him the vote, besides it being a Democratic neighborhood that was doing the voting, and besides her having that very up-close personal campaign style, I think what in the end actually lost him the vote was his sexism. He was incredibly
sexist. Which we talked about when we talked about, you know, Rosa Parks and the NAACP.
He was a Black man, but he was super sexist, and he said that they needed a man's voice in Washington, which there were already a ton of men in Washington. Right. And he called her a bossy female. And a
like
little,
a nasty woman. I'll get you.
And a little school teacher.
Ooh, love it.
So
throw it at me.
Basically, but it ended up backfiring for him because basically what she said was, there are a lot of men in Congress, and what are they getting done? And what can you get done that I can't get done?
Okay, so I'm one of those people where I need to look at a picture of a person when we're talking about them, and this might be the cutest woman I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Through all stages of life, I'm seeing childhood photos, older photos. Look at her.
She has a lisp, too.
Yo,
which
this
also,
girl.
She has a lisp, which also makes her so endearing to me. Like, I couldn't find the rights on her campaign speech, because I really wanted to play a bit of her campaign speech to really, like, emphasize what an incredible orator she was. But I couldn't find the rights on it, and I didn't want to play it if I, you know, we didn't have the rights. But,
oh my God, she's
incredible. She's
like,
so she ended up winning against James Farmer, who was this, super sexist guy. And she won with 67% of the vote.
Wow.
And became the first Black woman in Congress.
Love it.
Yeah.
Girl. Get it.
So she didn't stop there. Listen,
no,
she kept
of course
going.
Not. Shirley needs more. Shirley deserves the best and deserves all of it.
So when Shirley arrived in Washington, she faced incredible discrimination, of course, from all of her male fellow congresspeople. Mm-hmm. But even so, she said, I have no intention of sitting back and observing.
Uh-uh.
Which, as a junior congressperson, though, is kind of what they expect you to do. Like,
yeah.
They kind of expect any junior congressperson to sit there and shut up. And
not Shirley.
Kind of take, not Shirley.
She's like us. She likes to talk. And voice her opinion.
Yeah, girl, you're going to love this. In her first floor speech in 1969, she comes in hot, slamming the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Fighting Shirley, which is what her, like, thing was whenever she would, like, she would ride in the, when she was campaigning, she would ride in the back of, like, an open bed truck with a loudspeaker. And it was, like, fighting Shirley Chisholm, like, coming into, coming into your neighborhood, right?
What? Mm-hmm. Yes, girl.
She introduced more than 50 pieces of legislation and championed racial and gender equality, the plight of the poor, and ending the Vietnam War. She supported increases in funding to expand the hours of daycare facilities. She sponsored a guaranteed minimum income for families.
Love it.
And she launched a supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, a.k.a. WIC, what we now call WIC, which is that... it's a supplemental program for, like, specializing in pregnant women in particular, but women, infants, and children.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, she was really out there, like, championing for, like, the everyday man, like,
yeah.
the real people of this country, you know?
Ugh, we need her now.
Working people and children.
Her. Can you imagine her confronting Donald Trump and being like,
Oh, my God. If she was still around, she's one of those people who I totally wish was still around today
yes!
to comment
oh
on this.
Oh, my God. Like, I would follow her Twitter feed.
Absolutely.
I would get a personal Twitter for this woman.
Her and Auntie Maxine are just having tea and freaking, like,
oh, she's
Maxine Waters.
She's, like, somewhere in the afterlife, just, like, raging.
Shirley also worked to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, the mm-hmm. ERA, and... So the Equal Rights Amendment basically stated that equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on the account of sex. It's time to tackle the most subtle, most pervasive, and most institutionalized form of discrimination that exists. Sex-based discrimination.
Love it.
Even though it ended up, like, spoiler alert, the ERA ended up not being ratified, she delivered a speech... to her fellow congresspeople. And this is what I mean when I say she was such a powerful speaker, because she's in a room full of all men.
Yeah.
And she managed to deliver this speech that highlighted the ways in which sex-based discrimination harmed women and limited women's opportunities, basically saying that women were often regulated to lower-paying jobs, women were barred from service in the military. And when she said that, she didn't just say that the military delivers, like, well-paying jobs and women deserve to get those jobs, but she also said, hey, women want to serve their country, too. They're proud of their country, too. And
it's not just about the money.
From
it's
doing
that
it.
We have the right to do what we want to do. Yeah.
And that women were often barred from college campuses, et cetera. And I don't have the number here, but it was something like the vote passed to try and get this ratified from Congress with, like, 200-something to, like, 30. Like, she was able to convince, like, that many people, this one woman, you know.
And it didn't pass?
It had to pass, like, every state.
Right.
And there was this woman who was coming up at the same time as Shirley on the other end of the spectrum. Her name was Phyllis Schlafly, which, like, what a name.
She just sounds like, meh.
Doesn't she? She is. Meh. She was anti-feminist, and she was really...
Donald Trump's grandmother?
Sounds like it. She was really fanning the flames of fear, trying to, like, fear-monger about, well, you, like, it was this benevolent...
How are you anti-feminist and then also trying to be a female congressperson?
She wasn't trying to be a congressperson, but yeah,
What was she then? Because I thought she was, like...
She wasn't... She was just kind of, like, a voice of...
Oh.
Like, just a very prominent voice of anti-sexism, or anti-feminism.
That doesn't matter. You're still a woman with a prominent voice. Isn't that feminism?
She believed in benevolent sexism is what they call it, which is basically saying, like, look, don't you want us to maintain our place in society? Kind of like what I was talking about with
the
gender truth.
But just the whole, like... The whole idea of a woman being prominent in anything to me, I feel like is
well, I feel
a
that
form
way
of like feminism.
I feel that way about a lot of women nowadays too.
Oh, it's true. It's one of those things where it just doesn't make any sense. But continue.
In an effort to shut Shirley up
again,
because everyone seems to want to do that, Shirley was assigned to the Committee of Agriculture in Congress when she got there, and it is customary, again, for you to be a junior congressperson to just accept whatever posts they give you, right? Yeah. She did not accept it because, as she put it, agriculture was unimportant to her district in Brooklyn because there aren't farmers in Brooklyn. You know what I mean? So
can't deny it.
And I didn't write it down, but there was some quote by her that was really funny because, you know, there's that book, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And she said, I guess all they know about Brooklyn is that a tree once grew there. So she took her complaint to the head of whoever it was, and basically they kind of, like, patted her on the head and told her, like, look, you just need to do what we tell you to do, right? And so then she took her complaint to the House floor and was eventually reassigned to the Veterans Affairs Committee, which was still not her first choice, but she took it, and she was quoted as saying, yeah, but there are a lot more veterans in my district than trees.
That's true.
So, you know, she wasn't one to, like... She wasn't just going to lay down and take whatever people gave her. But
she was willing to compromise in some way.
She was willing to compromise.
She wasn't being difficult for the sake of being difficult.
No, she was willing to compromise if she thought she could do some good there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
She wasn't
going to
do...
That's still something for her to be able to make a difference in.
So before I get into the biggest thing that she's really known for, I'm going to just cover some of her accomplishments right
do
quick.
Do it.
So 71 to 77, she served in the Committee of Education and Labor. In 1971, she became a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, which still exists today.
Caucus.
Caucus. They're the ones who, if you watched President... If you watched Trump's State of the Union...
Thank you.
And you saw all the black people in their kind of, like... in their, like, African robes, who were just kind of like, you know, whenever Trump was talking. They're the Congressional Black Caucus.
Love it.
Which is basically black members of Congress.
Yeah.
Who focused on black issues.
Yeah.
77 to 81, she served as Secretary of the Democratic Caucus.
Love it.
In 1977, she served as the first black woman and second woman ever to serve on the Congressional Rules Committee. And she was also a founding member of the Congressional Women's Caucus. So,
can you say that word one more time for me?
Caucus.
Oh, girl.
Okay, so that's a lot.
It's amazing.
That's a lot already. Here's the big thing that I can't believe we didn't know about. You know, especially with everything with Obama and then with Hillary, and you're hearing first.
Yeah.
Well. Shirley Chisholm ran for president.
Shirley, girl.
In 1972, Shirley became the first woman and the first African-American to seek nomination for president of the United States from one of the two major political parties.
Wow.
Her motto remained unbought and unbossed throughout her presidential campaign. In her speech to announce her candidacy, which I suggest you all look up on YouTube because it's amazing, she said, I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I am not the candidate for the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, I am equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. I stand here now without endorsements from many big-name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop. I do not intend to offer you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been an accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate for the people of America. And she started facing difficulties right away from both sides because black people didn't want her to talk about women's issues.
Yeah.
And they thought that she would kind of sell out the black movement for women's issues. And women didn't want her to talk about black issues.
Yeah.
So she was kind of stuck in the middle. But
Shirley does what Shirley wants to do.
And she found that her womanness is actually what caused her greater issue than her blackness because people on both sides, black or white, men on both sides, were sexist. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're getting racism from one side, but you're getting sexism from both sides.
Yeah. Who won that year?
That was the year, I think Nixon won.
Oh.
Yeah.
We could have done so much better.
I know. But she famously said, the emotional, sexual, and psychological stereotyping of females begins when the doctor says, it's a girl. And tremendous amounts of talent are lost to our society just because that talent wears a skirt.
Mm.
However, despite the fact that Chisholm you know, so she got, it was a lot of sexism she received. Yeah. But then on the other side of the coin, you know, we were just talking about Gloria Steinem. Well, she spent a lot of time with Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug, who were like founding members of NOW, the National Organization for Women. And they were prominent members in the second wave movement. And initially they all backed her. They backed Shirley because Shirley's like a hardcore feminist, you know, outspoken feminist. But at the end of the day, like, as things went on, and what was a really sad part of this documentary when you watched Shirley, old Shirley, talk about it, was that these women slowly started to back away from her.
Why?
Because there were so many Democratic, people running for the Democratic ticket that they wanted to
back someone who they thought would actually win?
Yeah. And as did members of the Congressional Black Caucus did the same thing. So she had a few people from the Congressional Black Caucus who backed her, but mostly they backed George McGovern, who ended up getting the nomination. So, but she actually, you know, ended up saying, if you can't support me or can't endorse me, get out of my way. You do your thing and I'll do mine. And when a reporter asked her who, what she thought of some of her male colleagues of the Congressional Black Caucus disagreeing with her candidacy, she said, I'm looking to no man for approval of what I am doing.
Love it.
So she was, you know, discrimination followed her the whole time. Yeah. She was blocked from television debates. Like, they didn't want her on TV. And she had to actually sue them and take legal action in order to get on for just one speech. And she was constantly encouraged to drop out so that McGovern could receive the delegates to clinch the nomination. But she refused to back down all the way to the Democratic convention. Yeah. And part of the reason why was because she wanted to have enough delegates that she could have a bargaining chip. She knew she couldn't win at this point, right?
Yeah.
But she wanted to have enough delegates that she could say, whoever, if it gets deadlocked and I have to break a tie, I can say, I'm going to give you my delegates, but here's what I want.
Yes!
And what she wanted was a... So she showed up, actually, with 152 delegates, which was more than a lot of the other...
Yeah.
I think more than anyone but McGovern had.
Yeah.
And she wanted to be able to bargain and say, here's what I want. I want a... I want you to have a black running mate on your ticket.
Yeah.
I want you to have a woman in the cabinet, and I want a Native American to serve as Secretary of the Interior. Because Secretary of the Interior, they're the people who oversee Native American land.
Yeah.
And she was, like, really adamant that a Native American person should be in that post. Man, so she was just intersectional all the way around.
I mean, this is the thing. You know, the first thing you said is, I can't believe I learned this in school.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. I get. I mean, I don't understand, like, we should have learned about her in school, but, like, she's, like, I feel like she would have been too radical. Like, I mean, we think of Martin Luther King, the people that we did learn about, and they were very, very radical. But, I mean, like, this woman, it's, like, one thing after another, just, like, radical.
She never stopped, and she never shut up.
And, like, I feel like also, like, with us being from the Midwest, like, can you imagine, like, a Midwest, like, white woman trying to, like, back in the 90s, try to explain, you know what I mean? It's just,
well,
like...
because I think when you look at what she wanted, you kind of have to examine why people push so hard against those things, because it's not like, you know, I feel like so often when it's a black person, the thing that people say, you know, is that it's because it's like, oh, it's black issues all the time. But that's not what she was doing. Like,
no.
She was pushing for the issues of women and all minorities and poor people. And she wanted, you know, even if it wasn't her, she wanted other, like, black people to be in office.
Yeah.
She wanted Native Americans to be in office who are woefully unrepresented, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, she, again, very ahead of her time.
And very idealistic. Like, she was a very idealistic person. She wanted our world in the best way. And in her autobiography, she also said that, I am a national figure because I am the first person in 192 years to be at once a congressman, black, and a woman, proves, I would think, that our society is not yet just or free.
Yeah.
So, despite losing the nomination and becoming disillusioned with politics, she remained a popular figure when she returned to Congress. In 1974, in a Gallup poll, she was listed as one of the top 10 most admired women ahead of Jackie O and Coretta Scott King.
Love it!
So, but she was really, she was disillusioned with
How
it.
How is she so forgotten?
I don't know. Like, that's what I mean. Like, I don't know how I didn't know about her. I only knew about her whenever Hillary was running and somebody was like, hey, by the way, she's not the first person to do this.
Yeah.
This is the first person who did this, you know what yeah. I mean? And she deserves her, you know, place in history. But she became really discouraged with... Because she basically was like, democracy is not as democratic as you think. It's no. a lot of, like, underhand deals, yeah. like what we were saying. And it really did bother her because that's yeah. not who she was.
Yeah.
And in 1982, she became so discouraged with the country's conservative turn after Ronald Reagan was elected that she announced that she would not run for re-election for Congress.
Yeah, because it wasn't complicit with who she was, the person.
And everything she was trying for, it kind of felt like... And it felt like the way the country was going, and I'm sure that whole, like, feeling that she had when she was running, when so yeah. many people were being really progressive,
uh-huh.
and then seeing, like, Nixon get elected, and then Reagan get elected.
Yeah, how discouraging.
Mm-hmm. So she went on, after that, to teach at Mount Holyoke College, and she co-founded the National Political Congress of Black Women. In 1991, she moved to Florida and later declined the nomination from Clinton to become the U.S. ambassador to Jamaica due to ill health. She continued to lecture until her death on January 1st in 2005.
Wow.
10 years later, in 2015, Obama posthumously awarded her the Congressional Medal of Freedom. And of Shirley, he had to say this. Shirley Chisholm's example transcends her life. And when asked how she'd like to be remembered, she had an answer. I'd like them to say that Shirley Chisholm had guts. And I'm proud to say it. Shirley Chisholm had guts.
I love it.
So that is Shirley.
I love you,
and she's
Shirley.
One of my new favorite people.
Yes.
I encourage you. She's so freaking adorable and endearing.
She's so cute, yet she's such a badass.
Yeah, she's so endearing and at once so powerful. And you can see her. She wears her, like... emotion, like, not in the way that people like to say it about women, that they wear yeah. their emotions on their sleeve, but in the way that a man does. Like, she's yeah. so upfront and honest
yeah.
about what she's feeling at any given moment. Like, yeah. at one point, an interviewer is, like, when she finally gets on the air after, like, petitioning.
Yeah.
And he said something, she said something about, he was, who would you support if you, Muskie or McGovern, who would you support if you didn't get the nomination? And she said, well, first, I'm still in this. And you can see her get angry. And then she's like, and two, I wouldn't make an answer right now because I don't know who else is on the ticket. You know, that's very important, who would be their running partner.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, would you be interested in being someone's running partner? And she was so mad. And she was like, I'm running for the President of the United States, and I think I can hold that office. Thank you.
Yes!
Like, you know. So,
I love it. I love it.
Yes. So we hope you guys kind of enjoyed today's episode.
I enjoyed it so much.
So did I. So did I. And I hope you learned some new things about some really powerful, wonderful women.
Yeah.
And I hope you've had a really kick-ass Black History Month.
Yeah, for you know? Real. I had a very... This is probably the best Black History Month I've ever had.
Yeah.
I was going to add something I totally forgot to say at the end of mine. She changed her name again to Gamba Adisa before she died, which
oh, yeah.
means warrior, she who makes her meaning known.
That's awesome.
Because when you were saying the name of the Black... What was it? Apathy? Not apathy.
Apathy. Apathy. Please don't name your college group, social group, apathy. There's enough of that on college campuses, I feel like. You know what I mean?
Unless it's sarcastic. Oy. Oy, oy, oy. Yeah. So I thought that was cool. Yeah, this was great. I'm really glad that we got to do this together.
Yeah, me too. And we will end up eventually doing just kind of like broad feminist topics. I know we did get a message on our Instagram. Thank you to whoever sent us that message. Asking that we do, they really wanted us to cover like a topic on periods, which we will totally do.
Oh my, we've already been preparing for that.
Yeah,
like it's gonna happen.
Don't worry, that's gonna happen. We're definitely gonna cover more broad topics. I know we've been doing themed topics, which I don't know if everyone's kind of like into or not, but yeah,
but we, I mean, I think what's going to keep it interesting for us too is to be mixing it up, but definitely yeah. because it's Black History Month and then Women's History Month, that we're going to keep it pretty themed for a while, but trust me, there's,
yeah,
Keegan has a list, like we're booked until like next year of topics we want to talk about, like it's crazy.
Yeah, coming in April, we're going to start doing more broad topics, but I'm actually really excited for Women's History Month.
Me too. Because, well, I mean, that's, there's so much that goes into
it. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a lot of work, but I'm actually really excited to do, we're going to do, I know we've said this before, but we're going to do the waves of feminism one every week. So our first, so next week we're going to cover the first wave feminists and the suffragette movement and what all of that meant. So, you know, if you were interested in hearing that, you know, hit us up, come back. Come back to us.
And if you are concerned that we don't have something on our list that you do want to hear, you know, like that woman had contacted us, feel free. Like, leave us a message and let us know what you want to hear us talk about. We like criticism. We like comments. We like ideas.
What are your ideas? I'm just open to hearing that.
Like, because for me, it's at this point, like, we're still so new that it's like, are people actually out there?
Sometimes it doesn't feel like it. Sometimes it kind of feels like we're talking to ourselves.
So the fact that somebody did reach out and it's someone that neither of us know in our lives personally. You're like, yes, we made it. We made it. We're big.
We have won. So definitely drop us a line. You can send us a DM on Instagram like that woman did. Our Instagram is Angry Neighborhood Feminist. We do have a Twitter that we don't keep up with, and we're sorry, but it is YAMF Podcast. YAMF? That's not right.
It is YAMF. YANF Podcast. Gosh, isn't it just YAMF?
It's hard to say it because it sounds like YAMPH, but that's not it. So yeah, YANF Podcast is our Twitter. And then our email is neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. So the email address is always in our show notes. So, you know, you can go ahead and click on that if you're using Apple Podcasts.
Yep.
And we are found, you know, wherever you're listening now, Apple Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, we're on Google Play. We are working on getting up on iHeartRadio and Spotify and some other platforms. But yeah. It's just taking a while.
So annoying. But we'll get there.
Yeah, we will. And thank you so much for listening.
We really, really appreciate you. And we encourage you to
rage on.